Thanks, Jacopo. And before I begin, thanks to the organizers, especially Mohammed, for giving this wonderful opportunity to present our new results. So I'm from Altaja's group at ETH Zurich, and today I'll talk about a new two-dimensional material system and tell you a little bit about its unique properties, and then maybe discuss the prospects to realize strongly interacting photons in these materials. So the material system is a transition metal dichalcogenide, or TMDs. And some of you may be aware of these materials. They are heavily studied now in solid state community. And so the generic formula for TMDs is MX2, where M is the transition metal, which comes from this block. And X is the chalcogen, so that's this column. And these are, just like graphene or graphite, these are layered materials. So you can use the same techniques. You can exfoliate to get a single layer, two-dimensional crystal. And there's a huge variety of these systems. And they also come in a wide range of electronic properties. So you have the semiconducting sulfides and selenides of moly and tungsten. You also have the semi-metallic species and more exotic systems where you can have a charge density order or competition with superconductivity. That part actually stems from the d electrons of transition metal. But for today's talk, I'll focus mainly on selenides of molybdenum and tungsten. So here's the crystal structure. So as I said, these are layered materials. And so if you look at bulk, layers are arranged such that you have inversion symmetry, so about the center. But then if you go to one monolayer, which is actually a sandwich structure, two times the chalcogens, and then the transition metal is sandwiched in between the two layers. So one layer breaks inversion symmetry. So as you can see, there's mirror symmetry about this plane, but not inversion symmetry. Another way to look at this is, if you look from the top, this looks pretty much like a honeycomb lattice. Now, the A and B sublattices are now occupied by different atoms, and that breaks the inversion symmetry. And so this leads to, so think of graphene. Now you break inversion symmetry, you get a mass gap. So this opens up a gap in the band structure. So here, for example, that's where the low energy physics takes place, and we refer to that as a valley. And because you have a honeycomb lattice, you have inequivalent points in the valley, in the Brillouin zone. That's where the energy minima is. So these are now your two valleys, just like you have in graphene. And if you zoom in at the valleys, the band structure looks like this. So first thing you realize is that the carriers come in two valley flavors, K and minus K, or K or K prime. And you have a large gap, which is in the visible or near infrared. And you also have a large spin orbit interaction for both conduction and valence band. And that leads to actually valley spin locking. So if, let's say, I fix my valley and I say I'm in K valley at this energy, then the spin is automatically fixed to spin up. And the way to think about these valleys is that they are essentially time reversal partners of each other. So if you go from one to the other, everything is flipped, so the spin is flipped and so on. It turns out that S sub Z is still a good quantum number, even though you have a spin orbit interaction. Okay, so with that introduction, I come to the outline of my talk. So first I'll talk about optics with TMDs. We'll see that one can use light to manipulate the valley degree of freedom, just like one does for spin in 3-5 semiconductors. Then I'll talk about an experiment we performed to realize valley Zeeman effect. And we'll see there are strongly bound excitons in this system. And then there have been a lot of discussion about synthetic gauge field in this conference. So we'll see that this material actually offers you a natural gauge field. So in particular, there's Berry curvature, non-zero Berry curvature. And theoretically, we have investigated that. And it turns out that there are optical signatures of that very curvature which show up in excitonic fine structure. And then finally, I'll talk about strong light-matter coupling, so our recent observation of cavity polaritons, and also trion polaritons, which can be used to make interacting photons. And then another ingredient for this lattice model is the presence of nonlinearity on-site, for example. And I'll show that we have seen quantum dots, which can be actually used for getting this nonlinearity. OK, so as far as the optical selection rules are concerned, they are sigma polarized, circularly polarized. So essentially, the two values are time reversal partners. So if one is sigma minus polarized, the other is sigma plus. So this way, you can, just by choosing the helicity of light, address one value at a time. So that gives you addressability. And also, you have a spin value locking. So the intervalley scattering is reduced or suppressed, because now you have to not only flip the spin, but also provide a large momentum transfer. So these are on the edge of Brillouin zone. So you have almost 1 over the lattice constant of momentum to provide. So that gives it more robustness. The valley index is more robust against scattering. And so what people have seen is if you shine a sigma polarized light and only excite carriers in one valley, then the emission is also co-polarized. It's also, let's say, the same sigma polarized. So the valley, that shows that the scattering is indeed suppressed up to the lifetime. Now, you can also create a valley coherence. So you can think of exciting the system with linearly polarized lights, which is a superposition of the two circularly polarized lights. And then you create a superposition of the valleys. And people have seen that also the emission which comes out is linearly polarized. So it's collinearly polarized, which means that the valley coherence is also preserved. So just like you can have a spin coherence, you here have valley coherence, and you can think of a qubit now, which is like a spin qubit. Although spin and valley are tied, so you can choose whatever you want to use. Yes? So the question is whether this is on resonance. It's close to resonance. So it's quasi. So what they found is that if you pump really away from the resonance, there is not much valley coherence or valley polarization left. But if you are close, so I guess the right scale would be the exciton binding energy. We'll come to that. So if you're within that, then the, and also I guess you have to be close to k equal to 0. So exchange can complicate things, but I don't want to dwell on that. OK, so basically what I want to say here is that valley is now like a quantum degree of freedom, just like spin. So you can, so the first experiment we performed was to check whether this valley degeneracy can be lifted by magnetic field, just like Zeeman effect in for spins. So indeed, that happens. So if you see on this plot, I'm plotting the emission, and the blue and red are different circularly polarized emission. And so as I ramp up the field, these lines split, and I know that the emission is coming, the circularly polarized light is coming from different valleys. So essentially, the valleys are splitting. So. And so then you can say that there is a magnetic moment associated with the valley. And it turns out it's not the spin which is important here. So the Zeeman effect will be essentially a rigid shift of both the bands. And in optics, we are sensitive to the difference. So in optics, we cannot really detect a Zeeman kind of effect. So it's basically a completely orbital effect. And that is also confirmed by a very anisotropic response. So this is for the case when B field is perpendicular to the sample. So if you apply in-plane field, basically don't see any splitting up to 10 tesla or so. So that's confirmed. That confirms that this is an orbital, because your orbital circulations are within the plane. Okay, so how do we understand this? We call it Valisyman effect. How do we understand it? So there's a contribution coming from the d orbital. So the d orbital themselves have some angular momentum that gives you some magnetic moment. So that's kind of the boring contribution. But then there's another interesting contribution which comes from what is called as the intercellular contribution. So this is a geometric effect, actually. I'll talk about that a little later. But essentially, the picture is that if you look at the block wave functions, say for the conduction band, which is made only from the A sublattices, and valence band is made only from the B at the K point. So if you look at the phase of the block wave function, it has this winding. And at K point, the winding is, let's say, clockwise. So you go from 0 to pi by 3, 4 pi by 3, and so on. And in the minus k or k prime valley, it's counterclockwise. So essentially, you have some kind of a circulation. And that also has its own orbital magnetic moment. And that also contributes in this splitting. But there's more to it, so there are details. But this single particle picture I just talked about is not really valid because you have a very strong Coulomb interaction in this material. So the right quasi-particles are excitons, which are involved in the optical transitions. And they are tightly bound. The binding energy is about 150 to 600, depending upon whom you ask. And the Bohr radius is tiny. It's about 1 to 2 nanometers. So essentially, the exciton is spread now in K space. So you can't really talk about K and K prime valley, just K and K prime valley. So it has some spread. So you have to include all that to explain what the quantitative value of magnetic moment. Just as a comment, trions, which are charged excitons, so like two electrons in a hole, these are also very stable. They can be stable up to room temperature, and they show anomalous magnetic moment, which I don't have time to talk about.
Excuse me, is there a symmetry between electron doping and hole doping in these systems?
So the question is there particle hole symmetry, right? No, there is actually, that's the point of, sorry. So here, actually, the contribution is mainly coming from the conduction band, the valence band, and the conduction band doesn't have any angular momentum. Likewise, if you just consider a two-band model, this thing actually cancels out because the difference of the two bands enters. So if you have particle hole symmetry, then this is a vanishing effect. But here you actually go beyond the two-band model, so that gives you a contribution. Okay. So then I move on to the next part, which is about the cage field or pericurvature. So a very quick reminder, most of you are.
I'm trying to understand. If the spin orbital coupling in this system large, this is d orbital?
Yes, it's very large, yes. But you see, so if you naively think of spin orbit as something like L dot S, you have a two-dimensional system, right? So L has to be out of plane. So L is only L sub Z, and so L dot S becomes LZ sub Z, S sub Z. So S sub Z is a good quantum number. Yeah. So for optics, you can think that spin is just going to piggyback on the transition, and it's only the orbital angular momentum which will play a role. Yes. Right. So what I meant is, so when you create these electron hole pairs in,
exciton.
Yes, exciton, right.
Or trion. Due to cooling.
Yes. So when you make these electron hole pairs, they are very tightly bound. So that gives you exciton, and if there is some residual doping or carrier density, you can form a trion, like a three particle composite quasi particle, charged. So people have seen both negatively and positively charged. But normally, these systems are electron doped. Even if you don't do much, they are naturally electron doped. So most of the time, we observe negatively charged trions.
So this exciton also carry angular momentum? Orbital angular momentum is exciton?
Yes, we'll come to that, actually. Yeah. you'll see that that actually splits in the Berry curvature. Okay. Right, so a quick reminder, if you just consider a two-band model, so basically graphene, but now with a gap, we know that once you break inversion symmetry, you get a band gap, but also you get a Berry curvature, which is now finite. So a Berry curvature is essentially like a gauge field, so you have a Berry potential, which just depends on your block eigenstates, and in particular how they're arranged in k-space, because how they change with k. And curl of that is the Berry curvature, so that's just like your magnetic field, but now it's in reciprocal space. So the parameter is momentum, k, rather than real space. So there is a finite Berry curvature, but because you have time reversal symmetry, the Berry curvature is opposite in the two valleys. And so overall, you don't have any Berry curvature. So if you calculate the Chern number, you integrate over the whole Brillouin zone, you get zero for Chern number. So there is no topology. Topologically, it's trivial, but there's a non-trivial geometry. And because we can access one valley at a time, we can probe this this finite Berry curvature or a magnetic field in reciprocal space. So what are the physical signatures of this Berry curvature? So the most popular example is single particle transport. So essentially you make this analogy, a dual analogy. So you simply replace position by momentum and a magnetic field in real space by Berry curvature in k space. And so you're familiar with this equation. This is just a semi-classical equation for an electron in electric and magnetic field. So this is essentially just the Lorentz equation. This is the Lorentz term. If you take a dual of that, normally we only talk about this term. So that's essentially a group velocity coming from the dispersion. But if you have Berry curvature, that gives you an anomalous Hall velocity. So that makes these equations more symmetric. And indeed, people have observed valley Hall effect in this material recently. So that's the single particle transport, but you can then take this picture further. So you can make this dual space analogies. So this material serves as a nice playground to study dual of models with magnetic fields. So for example, analog of Zeeman effect happening in momentum space, or Landau levels in momentum space, and so on. And normally you do that by some kind of a pile substitution. So you replace now R with R plus the gauge potential. And if you have a potential energy term or interaction term, you can replace that and expand this to get effect of Berry curvature. So this recipe was formalized by Jacopo and Hanna. So next question we had was, can we find of any optical signatures? So most of the time we talk about transport and single particles. So here, can we find some optical signatures of Berry curvature? So this is a theoretical part of the talk. So if you look at exciton, essentially it's confined in real space, which means it's spread in k-space. So you can think of it as a superposition of particle hole excitations with different amplitudes. So that different amplitudes go in the make the excitonic wave function in k-space, and we are interested in solving for the eigen spectrum and eigenvalues. So if you take this, if you write the Schrodinger equation in k-space, it looks like this. So you have the kinetic energy part of the electron and hole. That's just the dispersion of conduction and valence band. And then you have the Fourier of your 2D Coulomb potential. That goes as 1 over k in 2D. And you also have this block part. So this is basically capturing the symmetry of the crystal. And so if you drop this block part and just look at this, which is normally done in most semiconductor textbooks, you end up with essentially a 2D hydrogen atom, assuming that the dispersions are parabolic. And so that gives you the usual 1s, 2s states. But so we wanted to study what happens because of this term, the block term. So if you write down the characteristic polynomial for the eigenvalue problem, you essentially start getting these loops in k-space. So essentially, block overlaps, which look like such a loop. So you go from k1, k2, and then kn is looped back to k1, the first point. And so with some mathematical tricks, you can recast this into this to first order. And so you see this is essentially the Berry phase contribution. And then you can do a Stokes, you can apply Stokes theorem to make this into, so this was Berry potential. This becomes now an area integral of your Berry curvature. And then you have this other term. But notice that these two terms are on equal footing. This is not a second order term because this is also second order in K. This is an area in K space. This is also a second order in K. So these are on same footing. But the main point is there is a Berry phase or a geometric contribution to this block part. And so one technical point, so if you naively expand the overlap in some kind of a Taylor series, you indeed get the first order term, you capture that here. And then you might think this is a higher order term and drop it with respect to this, and you lose this contribution. So the point is that one should do expansions also in a gauge invariant fashion. So essentially, there's no first order term. Everything is second order in K. OK, so let's look at this first contribution, first piece, and see what is the physical contribution of that. So I'll spare you the math, but now I'll make this analogy to a real space versus momentum space magnetic field. So let's say if you had your 2p states, which are degenerate for a hydrogen atom or an exciton, and you apply a real magnetic field, we know that that field will essentially mix the px and py states and give you a splitting. So something similar will happen in k-space as well. So you have now excitonic wave functions in k-space for 2p and 2px and 2py, which are degenerate, and you apply now a Berry curvature, which will essentially mix and split the states. So essentially, you have something like an orbital Zeeman effect happening in k-space. So this is essentially, you know, the angular momentum states, which are now getting split because of Berry curvature. And of course, you don't have a real magnetic field, so the splitting is opposite in the two values because of time reversal symmetry. And it turns out this is experimentally relevant for TMD. The splitting is, we think it's large enough to be able to actually measure it. We are currently, will soon perform the experiment and see if that's the case. Okay, then we can look at the second term here. Let's see what that does. So that term has a name. It's well known from at least 1980. It's called a quantum geometric tensor, or sometimes Fubini's 2D metric. This is actually just the real part of Fubini's 2D. And that looks like this. So essentially, it's a metric tensor. It measures distances in k-space. Square of distance. And so that you can recast as this, which looks like now a covariance. And if you identify these operator with some kind of a position operator, because that's partial in k, this is some kind of a spread in x. So essentially, the picture is we can make another analogy. We know that in hydrogen atoms, such a spread happens takes place for the position of electron and gives rise to a Lamb shift, so which actually arises from the vacuum fluctuation of your field. So here, the analogy is quite similar. You have a Lamb-like shift coming from this metric tensor. And you can make this statement more quantitative. So if you look at how this scales with a fine structure constant, you get basically the same kind of scaling which we have for Lamb shift in hydrogen atoms. So it scales something the same way as a fine structure constant and the mass. OK, so now we have an optical signature of Berry curvature, and that gives us some kind of a Zeeman effect and also a Lamb-like shift. And one thing to maybe emphasize here is that, you know, we are now beyond single particle picture. So these are quite trivial, just two particle correlation. But Berry curvature effects also show up in, you know, Coulomb bound states. OK, so then I move on to the last part of the talk, strong coupling with these systems. So as I mentioned before, you have strong interactions in Coulomb interactions in the system. And so in a 2D massive Dirac limit, you can write down the vacuum Rabi splitting as follows here. So this is just fine structure constant, dielectric constant. And this is the Dirac velocity of your two-dimensional model. But more importantly, it goes as 1 over the Bohr radius. And so as we know, that Bohr radius here is pretty small. You get a very large Rabi splitting of about 30 milliV. So comparing it to gallium arsenide, where it's 5 milliV, this is quite large. So this opens up the possibility of polariton condensation at room temperature and so on. And also, you can think of making trion polaritons, because trion binding energy is also very large, similar Bohr radius and so on. And also, you can think of using light to induce topology. And we'll hear more about this from Gil on Friday, so making topological polaritons. And on top of that, you have a value degree of freedom. So I don't know exactly what to do with that, but there is this additional internal symmetry. Maybe you can think of some kind of chiral polariton and so on. So that's why we are quite excited about this material for strong light interactions. So to measure this vacuum Rabi splitting, we have the following system. Essentially, we have a tunable microcavity. So you have a DBR mirror on bottom on which the sample is placed, a monolayer. And the other part of the mirror is actually a scanning fiber with a single mode fiber with a dimple on which you deposit and the same dielectric mirror. And then this would appear, so you can control and tune the cavity. So the setup looks something like this. Here's the piezo stack, and here's where the fiber comes out. So if I zoom in, maybe you can barely see this is the fiber sticking out, and the sample or this part is mounted upside down to do a transmission measurement. So Meinrad Ziedler, who's a PhD student involved in this project, recently measured this, and you can see very nice splitting of 25 milliV. This is for, I think, a 5 lambda cavity, so you can, in principle, get even larger. And similar results have been shown by Sasha Tartakovsky's group at Sheffield and Vinod Menon's group at CUNY. So indeed, there is a strong coupling, which is good, great news. Okay, 5 minutes. This is 4 Kelvin, yes. Yeah, so the lines are pretty broad at room temperature, so yeah, you need to cool it down. And then the next thing was to look for trion polaritons. So for this, we needed actually a sample where we could control the Fermi energy. So we want to dope the sample to get more electrons and make trions stable, and then look for trion polaritons. So here, this highlighted area is where the exciton resonance is. So if I kind of deplete the sample, then you see the exciton splitting is huge. So exciton dominates. And then as I start electron doping, the exciton splitting kind of decreases and then almost vanishes in this regime, right? And at the same time, this is the trion resonance, and so I'm making trions more favorable by doping the system. And you can clearly see that the trion splitting is increasing. And the maximum trion splitting we have observed so far is about 10 milliV, but I think we can probably do better. This was just last week. So this is great news. We have trion polaritons, so polaritons with a charge, and which are quite stable. So this opens up the possibility of realizing strongly interacting photons now. Perhaps we can use the charged trions to make these polaritons strongly interacting. On one hand, we have the 2D limit, which means the screening is reduced, which is good. But then also the Bohr radius is really tiny. So if you want to make these guys interact, you need very large density. So that's a drawback. But then recently, Charles Grenier from our group, together with Cristiano here, found out that when the trion vacuum splitting is comparable to the trion binding energy, then essentially your outer electron, so in trion you have the kind of like an exciton which drags an electron to make a trion. So when this condition is met, this outer electron essentially, the Bohr radius of outer electron is increased by 3 to 5 times, I suppose. And that's analogous to what you have in Rydberg excitation, right? So essentially you have now a large extended object, and that could help you increase the interaction. Okay, so finally, nonlinearities. We have also seen quantum emitters in the system. So if you look at, so this is one particular sample, and this is at low temperature, we see sometimes these sharp peaks. And if you zoom in at one of these peaks, they are rather sharp, about 100 times narrower than the line width. And still, I think this is limited by spectral diffusion, so this is 100 microeV, but probably it can go down even lower. And these are spatially localized. And of course, you can perform second-order correlation functions, correlation measurement for the photon statistics, and really see a nice G2 anti-bunching peak, which tells us that these systems are strongly anharmonic and zero-dimensional. So the outlook now is perhaps we can controllably introduce a nonlinearity, and this is an ongoing work with Misha's group. And so one scheme could be to use strain. So these are essentially two-dimensional membranes. So you can suspend them and stretch them in, by applying strain by either electrostatically or by AFM to kind of engineer the band gap. Or you could use gold nanoparticles and try to trap the exciton with the image charges. Or maybe a straightforward approach could be just use gates to because the Coulomb interactions are strong, everything is scaled up by one order of magnitude. Maybe just by gate you can get an optical confinement. Okay, so with that, I would like to thank colleagues. So Meinrad Siedler, who's a PhD student, was involved in all the experiments, and particularly he did the polariton experiments. Patrick Bach is also a PhD student. He was involved in making these really fancy and challenging samples for doing density-dependent measurements for trion polaritons. And of course, Attach was involved in everything. And Charles Grenier and Andras Kish provided us the first samples that we looked at. And I take this opportunity to flash advertise for postdoc position available in not Attach's group, in my group at Emory. So if you know people who are interested in postdoc, please spread the word. And thank you for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Ajit. Now questions. Jens? You should switch on.
Very nice. Could you, so there's this host of experiments from the Shayegan group at Princeton in a somewhat different system, but also on valleys, and they see strain effects, and they see valley ferromagnetism. They say they see valley fermions. Could you just briefly summarize how is their system different, and maybe also what are the similarities?
So I'm actually not aware of, so what material system?
This is semiconductor heterostructures.
Okay, so I must say I'm not familiar with the work, but valleys are present in many materials. So for example, silicon also has valley. But you know, here the interesting thing is these are really time reversal partners and so on. So in silicon, for example, that doesn't happen. And also this optical addressability, perhaps that's, but that's unique. But I must say I'm not aware, so I should look into that and compare.
Okay. So
yes.
This system has both excitons and trions.
Right.
So how can you control the chemical potential to get?
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, this system has both excitons and trions. So what's the chemical potential you can get rid of exciton? And,
right.
You tune the ratio of the exciton and the trion.
Yes, so that was actually this measurement I showed you here. So what we have is essentially, so you can use just an electrostatic back gate. to control the Fermi energy. So you have essentially two leads, or one lead will also do. And you have a back gate, which is essentially a heavily doped silicon, or you can even use graphite or graphene. So single layer of back gate. And you can control the density. So you can deplete the carriers and get towards exciton by applying a negative voltage, or you can, you know, attract carriers by applying positive voltage and get into a trion regime. Or you can probably go even further and look at maybe, you know, more interesting many body exciton and so on.
Concerning these really beautiful experiments, I did not understand, is this reflectivity or transmission? Or
this is transmission. This
have
is
you
transmission.
Tried to do photoluminescence experiments? And what happens if you increase the excitation power?
Yes, we are trying. So indeed, we pumped the system quite hard, or Meinrad did, and then we lost the flake.
Okay, you destroyed the sample.
Yes, and we were expecting some kind of interesting lasing kind of physics, but so far, no indication there.
But do you see any bottleneck, or I mean, do carrier relax, interact strongly?
You mean because of the dispersion? Because of the dispersion, you mean? Not really, not that.
So they are at k equals zero, the polaritons.
Actually, this eta is reproducing photoluminescence as well. That's fine.
Oh, okay, this I'm not aware.
So you
do
not have time to.
I was not even aware. So Meinrad is really busy with this experiment.
So just coming to this, back, you mentioned it very briefly, this Rydberg analogy to Rydberg.
Yes.
So one of the things that helps you in the case of Rydbergs is the lifetime increases as you go to sort of higher orbitals. Is there an analogous effect here?
So essentially what you're doing is you're going away from trions to exciton. So in that sense, we finally are limited then by the exciton oscillator strength, which you cannot really change in this system. And that's actually pretty large in the sense that the lifetime is short because these are really tightly bound excitons. But in polaritons, you can imagine a situation that you're really then limited by the cavity lifetime. So you can increase the lifetime up to the cavity, and that might help. We have not reached that regime yet.
I just have a quick question. So about the first part of your talk where you presented this Welle physics.
Yes.
So as far as I understand, it's actually somewhat kind of controversial to what extent this Welle degrees of freedom are good degrees of freedom. I think some experiments claim that the preservation is very good, but some are not. So can you just comment?
Yes, that's a very important point. In fact, I made a very simplistic picture just to introduce Welle. Valleys, but what happens is you also have exchange, which mixes the two valleys. So as soon as you go away from the k equal to zero, valleys are gone, essentially. Now, in most experiments, they were non-resonant. So in principle, there should be some component from higher k's which will mix the valleys. And also, it depends on the system. So for example, the cleaner moly-selenide system always shows a lower valley polarization. So there are things which we don't necessarily understand, and there are many theories why this happens, but I don't think there's a conclusion.
So is it your sense that if you basically go with resonant excitation, it should be better preserved?
That's the hope.
Yes.
So, but the light cone still, within the light cone there is about 1 mV. Which is comparable to the lifetime. So, but that's something one should really experimentally resolve.
So when you were mentioning the interaction effects of the trions, you were mainly focusing on like making them larger, which is probably like an exchange interaction effect, right? But what about the long range? I mean, they're charged, right?
So yes. So that should help also. Yeah.
So you don't necessarily need to make them large to have them strongly interact. Or is there a strong screening, or?
So in my understanding, yes, you should have long-range Coulomb interaction, which should help you anyways. But I think that's not the whole picture. So Attard seems to think that it's finally basically a dipole-dipole interaction. We were just discussing this yesterday, so we can discuss that later.
Yes.
Yes, you mentioned in some slide the idea of using these valleys to create car polaritons. Can you develop that a little bit more?
Yeah, I actually just put it there, so I just don't know what. So I've not given enough thought to how one can use the valley degree of freedom. I mean, one way could be, you know, go towards topological polaritons by this valley degree of freedom. Because you have this, you know, two circulating valleys, you can, if you can only address one at a time, maybe by applying a magnetic field in the proposal of Tosten, Charlie, and Gill, or then you can get some chirality. Or maybe you can induce by proximity ferromagnet, you can lift the valley degeneracy, and then you can indeed create some chiral polaritons. But I've not given enough thought, what can we do with that?
Other questions? If not, let's thank Ajit again. We can move on to the next speaker, which is Sriram Ganeshan, who will speak about the photonic quantum Hall effect and give us some lessons from the Chen Simons perspective.